This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we're going to be joined by representatives of the Lee County Homeless Coalition and Gulf Coast Partnerships in Charlotte County to discuss the events they're each holding this Friday evening to bring attention to the tragedy of homelessness and to memorialize those who died this past year while living on the streets of Southwest Florida. But first, earlier this month, the Environmental Protection Agency approved the use of the antibiotic oxytetracycline on citrus fruits grown in the U.S. The EPA's decision came just days after the agency approved residues of the antibiotic on fruit. According to the nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity, the decision could pave the way for up to 480,000 acres of citrus groves here in Florida to be treated with up to 388,000 pounds of oxytetracycline per year as a way to combat diseases like citrus canker and citrus greening. Since greening, or HLB, was first discovered in Florida in 2005, it spread to every citrus growing region of the state. The disease, spread by an invasive insect, ruins the fruit and eventually kills the tree. It's resulted in cumulative losses to Florida's citrus industry into the billions of dollars. The EPA's approval comes despite concerns expressed by both CDC and FDA officials, given the already growing prevalence of antibiotic-resistant infections. Joining me now for a closer look at the issue, the efficacy of oxytetracycline in combating citrus disease, and potential risks to environmental, and human health, is Center for Biological Diversity senior scientist Dr. Nathan Donnelly. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
We're also joined by Lee Health's Medical Director of Epidemiology and Infectious Disease Specialist, Dr. Mary Beth Saunders. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And we're also joined by Rick Dantzler. He's the Chief Operating Officer of the Citrus Research and Development Foundation. He's also a former state lawmaker, having served terms in both the Florida House and Senate. And he also served as Florida's Executive Director of the USDA's Farm Service Agency, among other endeavors. The foundation is a direct support organization for the University of Florida, namely the university's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences, and works to identify projects that will bring the most immediate practical value and relief to Florida growers. Thanks for taking the time today as well.
You bet, John. Good to be with you.
And as always, we invite listeners to join the conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And Rick Dantzler, I wanted to start with you. Is this EPA rule change something the Citrus Research and Development Foundation has been tracking?
We have been tracking it, John. It's not a new issue in the sense that the EPA decision essentially transferred a Section 18 permission for one of the three tetracycline or streptomycin products that were being used in Florida into a Section 3. I know that sounds a little bit technical, but a Section 18 is a permission given to use a product in an emergency condition, and there's a definition for an emergency condition. So this product has been used for the last 2 years under a Section 18 permission. And what the EPA decision did was transfer that to a Section 3 permission, which is a longer-term use, and it really makes it more of a permanent solution in the state. However, there are annual testing requirements and monitoring requirements for residuals and that sort of thing that have to be submitted to the EPA, and it's set to expire under its terms in the year 2025. It could happen earlier if the residual studies are problematic, but at this point it's set to be legal until 2025, but just for this one of three products.
Gotcha. And as you mentioned, oxytetracycline is currently being used in some groves here in Florida and has been for about 2 years. Given that I know the foundation you're with is closely watching any kind of research that can help us combat greening, looking for the most effective ones, has there been any kind of research results regarding the use of this particular antibiotic?
Well, not really. candidly, we don't have that much research data in our possession. What we have essentially is a compilation of grower surveys of about 50 growers, which tracks whether they believe the product has been helpful or not. There has been some residual monitoring as well. Those test results are being compiled as we speak by Dr. Eric Triplett with IFAS in Gainesville. But the residual studies also are performed by the registrants, the people that are actually selling the product. So there has been a lot of residual study done that has been submitted to EPA that I'm sure was factored into their decision. But to answer your question specifically, CRDF does not have a whole heck of a lot of data on this.
Okay. And forgive me for not doing this a little bit earlier in the conversation, but can we just take a step back and have you tell us just a little more generally about the work of the Citrus Research Foundation?
Yes. The Citrus Research and Development Foundation was created in 2009 as a direct response to citrus greening. While we fund research for a whole host of citrus-related diseases, about 90% of our money has gone towards HLB or citrus greening. We've funded, since our existence, a little over 400 projects, and we've spent about $130 million and, frankly, don't have a whole heck of a lot to show for it. We know more about greening than we ever have, but we haven't been able to give growers many tools with which they can combat this disease. So when oxytetracycline and streptomycin came on the scene 2 years ago, there was great excitement on the part of the citrus grower community because there was some feeling that we might have a tool that can provide some short-term relief. This compilation of grower surveys that I referenced earlier is really kind of a mixed bag. Some of the growers believe the product has helped them, and some believe that it has not. But the Citrus Research and Development Foundation gets an appropriation from the legislature. The citrus growers themselves have taxed themselves, and we get a small piece of the box tax that's levied every year to help support our research. So we've got money from a variety of sources. We take on a whole host of citrus-related diseases, but obviously we're very heavy to greening right now because it is so threatening.
Right. And, you know, it goes without saying that, you know, the use of oxytetracycline or any potential tool in this toolbox is aimed at increasing citrus yields and helping the industry here in Florida. And, you know, I did mention at the beginning, the top of the hour here, that greening first appeared here in 2005. But maybe for listeners who are maybe brand new to Florida and don't know about it, what has the impact been?
Well, it's just been enormous. I can recall when we would have harvests of approximately 250 million boxes, we're now down to 70. Not all of that is attributed to greening, of course. We've lost a lot of citrus land because of development and other things. But citrus acreage is down from 750,000 acres down to about 430. A grove that used to pick 600 or 700 boxes to the acre is lucky now to pick 200. And it's just been a devastating thing. The industry really thought it was receiving a death sentence 10 years ago. We have found a way to squeeze additional yield out of these greening-infected trees. But everyone, regardless of size, is hanging on by their fingertips right now. So that's why people became encouraged when these products became available. We're not oblivious to potential health risks, though, and we take seriously any of those concerns. But it's been a tough booger to crack. There's no question about that.
Right. If you're just joining the show today, we're discussing the use of the antibiotic oxytetracycline on citrus to combat diseases like canker and citrus greening. A recent rule change by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will allow more of the antibiotic to be used on citrus in Florida and elsewhere in the U.S. We're speaking with Rick Dantzler from the Citrus Research and Development Foundation, infectious disease specialist Dr. Mary Beth Saunders with Lee Health, and Dr. Nathan Donnelly, senior scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity, exploring the implications of this rule change. And if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call now. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And Dr. Mary Beth Saunders, let's just give us a little bit of a primer here. What is oxytetracycline? And as an antibiotic used to treat human problems, how would you characterize it? Is this a broad-spectrum antibiotic?
Well, it is a medically important class of antibiotics that's used to treat mainly skin and soft tissue infections and sometimes respiratory infections. So people may hear this, the common names of antibiotics that are like this, such as doxycycline, minocycline, when they go to their doctors and receive an antibiotic.
Okay. And, you know, with respiratory infections, I know one of those is pneumonia. Would you consider this a particularly important antibiotic that, you know, medical practitioners have in their toolbox to treat these kind of infections? Because, you know, pneumonia can be quite serious.
Well, it is very can be very specific for what is needed to be treated with it. So it is important because there are certain infections that will only respond to this class of antibiotics or respond better to this class of antibiotics than they might other antibiotics. So it is important in our toolbox.
Okay. And how commonly is this used, would you estimate?
This particular antibiotic, it's used very often in the outpatient setting when patients go into their practitioners and they may have an infection related to their skin.
And do you know if the kind used on citrus fruits is the same as what's used to treat infections in people?
It would be a similar product.
Okay. And let's just take a step back and maybe have you explain antibiotic resistance in general and how it develops.
Well, some bacteria have special mechanisms already to defend themselves against antibiotics, or they may learn how to defeat drugs that are intended to kill them. They develop these resistance patterns. So, and even when we have bacteria that are resistant, more importantly, those can grow in patients' bodies that may be found in their colon and other places that we don't think about. So while good bacteria may get removed by certain antibiotics, bacteria that are particularly resistant may continue to grow and cause patients to be sick, or in some cases, much harder to treat because we don't have a whole lot of antibiotics to treat the infection with.
Right. And the CDC characterizes antibiotic resistance as really one of the most urgent threats to public health today. It can cause illnesses that were once easily treatable to become untreatable. How would you characterize that threat, you know, particularly from where you sit, you know, directing epidemiology at a large health system, hospital system?
Well, thousands of people die throughout the United States each year from bacteria that are resistant to conventional antibiotics, and that we may have very few treatment options. So it's important that, you know, we continue to research and help develop new antibiotics. In fact, the National Plan to Combat Antibiotic Resistance has several goals for 2020, and that is to increase scientific research to help with clinical trials and to advance the discovery and development of new antibiotics and alternative therapies.
And what do we know about, you know, who to point the blame finger at when it comes to the rise of antibiotic-resistant infections? I mean, is it primarily doctors overprescribing antibiotics or patients asking for them when maybe they don't even need them? Or has the issue also been spurred significantly, do you think, by other antibiotic uses like the ones we're talking about today in the agriculture industry?
I think all of those areas are important in the development of antibiotic resistance. So, yes, it's very important for patients to understand that when a doctor says you have a respiratory virus and antibiotics are not needed, that they're really just trying to practice good antimicrobial stewardship and by not prescribing antibiotics unless it's truly indicated. But doctors will work closely with their microbiologists and pharmacists to make sure that patients do get placed on the right and correct antibiotics. So there does have to be understanding on both sides, patients to understand that, you know, the doctors are only going to treat them for when they suspect a bacterial infection, as well as doctors have to make sure that they are not succumbing to that pressure and using good judgment when prescribing antibiotics. And, of course, you know, in the agricultural industry, especially when it comes to antibiotics that are prescribed in the animal food industry, right, where we may see traces of antibiotics that remain in the food or in areas where food may be contaminated with animal feces and those resistant bacteria reside.
Well, on that note, I want to take a call from Julie in North Fort Myers because I think her questions pertain to what you were just talking about. Julie, thanks for calling Gulf Coast Live. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have a question with regard to whether these antibiotics that are applied to the trees make it into the fruit and therefore into the people who consume that fruit.
Dr. Saunders or Dr. Donnelly?
I can take this.
Okay.
I guess so. The Wang Wang Bing bacteria, which causes citrus greening, exists vascularly in the plant. So it makes its way from the roots to the trunk to the stem to the leaves, and it's all over the plant. And so the idea is that spraying oxytetracycline on the leaves, some of that drug will get absorbed and make its way into the vascular system of the plant, in which case, if the drug makes its way into the vascular system, it could make its way into the flesh of the fruit, probably at very, very low levels. And also, if you're spraying this on the leaves of the plant, then the fruit itself could get sprayed, and it could be present on the rind as well.
All right,
well,
thanks.
My question was based on an allergen, whether there are people who are sensitive to or allergic to certain antibiotics, including those two.
Oh, that's an interesting question I hadn't thought of. What if somebody has an allergy to a specific antibiotic that's used by the agriculture industry? Is that something that's a concern?
John, this is Rick. Could I comment on it?
Absolutely.
The caller raises a good point. And Dr. Donnelly is correct in his description of the morphology of the disease and the way the antibiotic works. Any application of streptomycin or oxytetracycline, there is a period of time that has to pass before the fruit can be harvested. And the reason for that is they want to make sure that the antibiotic is not in the fruit, that there aren't any kind of traces of the antibiotic in the fruit at the time it's harvested. So it's either 21 days or 41 or 40 days, depending on the product. But the point I really want to make is this bacteria lives in the phloem of the tree, which is the area right underneath the bark. And one of the things that the Citrus Research and Development Foundation is doing is funding research to try to figure out a way to inject the antibiotic directly into the phloem so it doesn't have to be sprayed on the leaves of the tree. That would be a much more efficient delivery system if we can figure that out. Unfortunately, that's not easy to do, and the cost of that can get so high that it becomes not feasible on a commercial basis.
Right.
But I think that's probably where our research is headed, to try to figure out a way to come up with a delivery device that gets the antibiotic directly into the phloem of the tree so that you don't have to spray it on the leaves.
Interesting, interesting. Julie, thanks so much for the call and the thoughtful question. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And Dr. Saunders, I know we're on a little bit of a side tangent here, but I just wanted to quickly ask, what's happening in terms of developing new antibiotics to stay ahead of resistance? Or is that really the answer? Is the answer really more about limiting our prescribing and exposure to antibiotics so that they don't get overused?
Well, both of the things that you mentioned are very important. It's developing new antibiotics to help against bacteria that may be more resistant, and that is part of what the understanding, that's part of the new antibiotics and alternative therapies that national plan to combat antibiotic resistance is doing to produce those new products and to develop alternatives to antibiotics to maybe help prevent disease in the future. In addition, doctors really do need to practice good, what we call antimicrobial stewardship, meaning that they are selecting antibiotics that are very narrow in spectrum, intended for only the disease that they suspect a patient has, and then a right prescribing time, making the amount of antibiotics they give a patient correct, not placing them on excessively long courses of antibiotics, and discontinuing the antibiotics as soon as possible in patients when they do not find an infection. Also, it's important for patients to take antibiotics as prescribed by their physician, because that also helps prevent the development of resistant antibiotic resistant organisms. If they take an antibiotic for a day or two and forget and then start it again, take it for another couple days, they may be, in fact, helping the bacteria develop increased resistance by not taking the medication properly.
And we've heard from Rick Dantzler from the Citrus Research and Development Foundation, you know, mentioned that this practice, as far as citrus groves has been concerned, has been going on for just about 2 years. So there, you know, we really don't have, you know, as much research as we would like at this point. But is this something that, as an infectious disease specialist, concerns you, the idea of allowing more of it to potentially be used?
Well, it is concerning, but I know that, you know, the EPA and doctors such as the ones that are on the call are really trying to be responsible in how they use these antibiotics. They understand the importance of antibiotic resistance, and they know it's important for the consumers to be aware and educated on this as well. So I feel that everyone working together and collaborating can have the best outcomes for all possible scenarios.
And again, if you're just joining our show today, we're talking with Dr. Mary Beth Saunders, infectious disease specialist with Lee Health, Rick Dantzler, COO at the Citrus Research and Development Foundation, and Dr. Nathan Donnelly, a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're exploring the use of the antibiotic oxytetracycline on citrus trees to combat diseases such as greening, and the EPA's new rule to allow growers to apply about 20 times as much of the antibiotic. And we're learning not only how it might help combat citrus diseases, but also potential to create antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And if you would like to weigh in on our conversation with a comment or question, phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And Nathan Donnelly, just tell us a bit about the Center for Biological Diversity and why this new EPA decision seems to be so high on your radar.
Yeah, so we're a national environmental nonprofit group dedicated to protecting the biodiversity of life on our planet. And what really sort of worries us about this is the scale of it. So as you mentioned earlier, you know, according to an analysis done by the manufacturer, this approval will result in nearly 400,000 pounds of this antibiotic to be used in plant agriculture every year. And just to put this in perspective, that's about 100,000 pounds more than all of the tetracyclines used in human medicine in a year being sprayed on plants. And it's expected to be sprayed on nearly 500,000 acres of citrus, mostly in Florida. There's also a small quarantined area in California as well. And this is worrisome on multiple fronts. I think the first really being that it's really unclear if it works that well. We know this is not a cure. And it's not really even a preventative. It's you know, these trees will still die of this disease, and this is basically a chronic treatment that will be applied up to 3 times a year, every year indefinitely. And everything in these citrus groves, from, you know, the smallest microbe to the largest bird or mammal that forages there, is going to be regularly exposed to this antibiotic year after year. And, you know, from published studies, we know that this can affect soil health, you know, for instance, by killing bacteria that digest organic matter and fix nitrogen. Tetracyclines have been shown quite extensively, actually, to decrease intestinal bacteria in bees, which of course can make them more susceptible to pathogen infection. And EPA's own analysis, when it approved this, found that long-term exposure can even harm small plant-eating mammals like, rabbits and little chipmunks if they forage in these fields. And then, of course, there's the potential for antibiotic resistance, and how big of a risk there is, we really just don't know at this point, because there isn't a ton of research out there on how antibiotic use, specifically in plant agriculture, can lead to resistance in human pathogens.
Are you concerned that there's something perhaps more political behind the EPA's decision rather than science-based?
Yeah, it's unclear whether this decision would have been made in a different administration or not. Clearly, the first emergency approval in 2016 was done under the Obama administration. So we know that there have been decisions in the pesticide office done under the Trump administration that probably would not have happened under a different one. But I think the problem really is the pesticide office itself at EPA really has problems that transcend even politics. this office is really, really captured, we believe, by large agribusinesses and pesticide companies. And the culture there is really, really focused towards catering to agricultural interests and catering to public health interests as a distant second.
And information I've read from the Center for Biological Diversity indicates that oxytetracycline isn't the only antibiotic you're worried about when it comes to agricultural uses. There's the aforementioned streptomycin and oxytetracycline calcium, which are, I guess, at some point in the pipeline towards approval on citrus crops. What can you tell us about that?
Right. So streptomycin has been approved on an emergency basis for the last 3 years, 2016 to 2018 in the state of Florida, and the state of California received its first emergency exemption in 2018 this year. So it has been used on an emergency basis, some company, I forget which, has applied for use on an ongoing basis, a Section 3 approval. And that's currently being analyzed by EPA. My guess is it will be approved probably sometime next year if things go according to how they did with this oxytetracycline approval. So, I think this sets really a very bad precedent. I mean, We've got tetracyclines on the table. We've got streptomycin on the table now. I mean, what happens if penicillins, which are even more important to human medicine than tetracyclines, are found to be effective pesticides for some, future outbreak? Are they on the table now? I mean, I feel like we're getting into a very slippery slope here, and unless the benefits are really enormous, I don't think the risks are worth it. And I absolutely agree with Rick. I mean, we need to find a fix for citrus greening disease, no doubt. But this knee-jerk reaction to spray a chemical over an enormous amount of land just really feeds into everything I think is wrong with modern agriculture. And I really wish we were smarter about this and trying to think more long-term.
Gotcha. Well, Dr. Mary Beth Saunders, I know you've got an epidemiology department for an entire healthcare system to run, so I know you need to go, but I wanted to say first, just thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and happy holidays to everyone. Thank you.
And I just want to take a couple more questions from callers we have on the line. First is David in North Fort Myers. David, thanks for calling the program. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I was wondering if anything is being done using bacteriophages, phage development, to develop a phage that would go after the citrus green bacteria.
Okay. In case you couldn't hear David there, he's asking about the use of bacterial phages as opposed to antibiotics when it comes to agricultural uses. Do either of you have anything to add on that particular question?
I don't. John, I've got a couple of comments though.
Sure.
But I have to tell you that I'm not a scientist. I don't even know what the phages is. So if David would elaborate a little bit and tell me about a specific compound, I might be able to respond more specifically. But I do have a comment about being a little bit hopeful about things that might get to Dr. Donnelly's concern when we get to that part in the program. But David, could you elaborate a little bit more on your question?
Yes, a phage. Phages are related to viruses in terms of the biology. It's an actual live a live organism, similar to a virus. But the phage development was used extensively in Russia. The use of phages because what they love to eat bacteria, and usually they can develop a phage that will go after a specific bacteria. So you can genetically develop a phage with a hunger for the right bacteria.
Okay.
So that's basically what it is. That's a whole different
approach.
Yeah,
I got it. There has been some research done on that. And let me tell you what really hampers our ability to make fast progress. This bacteria cannot be cultured. We cannot grow it in the lab, so we can't test things on it easily or quickly. My suspicion is that the bacteria is not going to be hard to kill if we can just get the killing agent into the phloem of the tree. We're working on a project right now with Ocean Spray, and I have their permission to share this. There is a compound within cranberry juice, for example, that early tests show to be extremely effective at killing this bacteria. And the cranberry industry has 1.2 billion barrels of cranberries that they're going to have to throw away if they can't find an alternative use for them by August of 2019. So we're trying to get something going with them. The point is, there is a lot we suspect that will kill bacteria, not just oxytetracycline or streptomycin or penicillin or these antibiotics that have been referred to, if we can just figure out a way to get the killing agent into the phloem of the tree.
David, thanks so much for the call and the thoughtful question. And Rick, I know that you had some other comments you wanted to respond to from a bit earlier in the conversation. I think that was a good time.
Well, that's fine, and I kind of did, John. I jumped the gun on you a little bit.
That's fine.
I'm just saying that the bacteria we suspect is not hard to kill. It's just a matter of getting the killing agent into the phloem of the tree to do the killing. And we've identified a lot of different things that can kill the bacteria if we can just reach it. So a lot of our work is being spent trying to get into the phloem of the tree efficiently. And if we can do that, then I think we're going to be able to make some real progress pretty quickly.
And I have one last question from a caller on the line. I'm just going to go ahead and throw it out there for the sake of time. He's asking about citrus juice imported into the country and whether that's tested for antibiotics versus, domestically produced citrus.
I don't know the answer to that specifically, but I can't imagine that any of the citrus processors that would be processing juice from other countries aren't checking the juice before they put it in the can or the bottle.
Gotcha. Well, that is about all the time we have for this portion of the show, but I did just want to give Dr. Donnelly one last opportunity to give us a final thought.
Yeah, absolutely. This is citrus screening is a huge problem. As Rick mentioned earlier, EPA did implement an automatic expiration of this after 7 years of this being approved, so in 2025. And to me, that really sort of goes to the heart of this approval, right? it really sort of proves the argument I'm making is this is not really the action of an agency that's confident in the safety of its decision. If the EPA were confident that this was not going to cause any issues, then it wouldn't be hedging its bet with this 7-year expiration, and that's exactly what it's doing here. And, you know, I think we need a federal agency that's honest when it can't come to a confident conclusion and to err on the side of caution when that's the case. And unfortunately, the pesticide office at the EPA consistently falls short of what we deserve.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, but I want to thank my guests. We just heard from Dr. Nathan Donnelly, senior scientist at the Nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity. We've also been speaking with Rick Dantzler. He's a former state lawmaker and chief operating officer at the Citrus Research and Development Foundation. Earlier, we were speaking with Dr. Mary Beth Saunders, infectious disease specialist with Lee Health. We're taking a short break, but when we return, advocates for the homeless and members of the public will gather Friday evening at 2 locations in Southwest Florida to honor and remember people who have died while living on the streets. WGCU's Julie Glenn will sit down with Executive Director of the Lee County Homeless Coalition and the Director of Coordinated Services at Gulf Coast Partnership in Punta Gorda to learn more. I'm John Davis, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.